X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube. Hey everybody, welcome back to X is for Podcast, the show where we take a look at comics, mutants, magic, and marvels week after week through their many monthly titles. I'm Nico, and you guys can catch me snickting along over on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction. It's another Marvel Fanfare Friday here, where we're going to be taking a look at all sorts of corners of the 616. We're going to kick things off with the most recent Marvel Holiday Special, a V-Day special featuring my boy Robbie Reyes, before we cut things over to Moon Knight number 8, and return to Marvel Unlimited to finish things out with Spider-Bot 1 through 6, one of the most adorable things we've covered on this show since Jeff the Land Shark, who, of course, did get mentioned in that coverage. Now, when I began looking at the Ghost Rider Valentine's Day special Infinity comic to do my research on it, and it made me remember, hey, there actually was a previous Ghost Rider Infinity comic, wasn't there, right? The Christmas special. We recently had Jonah cover it in our holiday roundup. So when I was scrolling through the Unlimited Infinity comic section, I couldn't find it, and I thought that was so weird. So I started searching around Unlimited, and I couldn't find anything about the Christmas Infinity comic, and that's when I realized it's an Infinite comic. And that was the first time that it really occurred to me that these were two separate products, the earlier line of Marvel digital comics versus the newer line. And as I did some digging, it actually turned out there were so many more Infinite comics than I ever knew. And a little bit of investigation led me to understand that not only were they different in name, but they're different in form and in many ways purpose. The Infinite comic program that Marvel started like a decade ago featured stories that seemed to tie in to things going on in the Marvel universe. So there were a lot of event prequels, and I think AVX had a few Infinite comic tie-in crossover moments. And because of that, I feel like Infinite comics were never really taken as seriously as they could have been. They always felt very much like something tacked on to a story, right? With a few really notable exceptions, one that comes to mind for me is Daredevil Road Warrior. Mark Waid has always been trying to push the digital comics experience and continue to help evolve the medium. So it made so much sense that during the peak of his Daredevil run, he would do a really awesome Infinite comic story. And I thought it was great at the time. I really loved reading it. It would go on to be collected in physical edition, which really helpful in the long term to keeping these stories alive and keeping them sort of central to the idea of what's going on in the rest of the Marvel Universe around them. Daredevil's Road Warrior would ultimately be collected in the Daredevil Wade Omnibus, so it felt real. The same thing with the AVX issues, and I guess for that reason, I never realized there were so many. I thought Marvel maybe did a handful of them and then kind of gave up till they relaunched on Marvel Unlimited. But some digging around led me to see that there were a number of Marvel Infinite issues, and beyond that, many of them fit that very motion comic style, like where you tapped and something on the panel changed, and it had a very animated feel. It felt like they were trying to push comics toward infinite possibilities more than anything. Now, the Infinity comic format is sort of an endless scrolling style, and these seem to be much more self-contained stories for the most part. The initial launch included the Unlimited Primers, as well as tie-ins to things like Kare Andrew's Amazing Fantasy series. But a lot of these have been either really accessible self-contained stories or have allowed titles like X-Men to tell stories about characters who aren't really appearing elsewhere. Now, in that same vein of mentioning that a number of the most significant Infinite comics did get reprinted, we're beginning to see a lot more of the X-Men Unlimited comics from the Infinity line get reprinted with both Longitude and X-Men Green seeing physical print. So once I'd sorted out my initial Infinite versus Infinity confusion, and I'd pieced together that while this is the first Ghost Rider Infinity comic, there was the Infinite holiday special before that, I thought, okay, so this is maybe the second Ghost Rider holiday special, but it's definitely not the second ever kind of Ghost Rider Robbie Reyes one-off, because something about Valentine's Day and love was ringing in my head, and that's when I remembered that there was the the Secret Wars Secret Love one-shot back in October of 2015 by a handful of amazing creators like Marguerite Bennett and Katie Cook and Chris Anka and Guru Hiru. And it featured stories like Robbie Reyes and Kamala Khan, as well as a sort of unusual Karen Page, Daredevil, Typhoid Mary kind of story. That it was just a really weird special, and it was a lot of fun, and it very much fit the Secret Wars era. But once again, this is sort of another entry of that Robbie Reyes into kind of the romance comic sphere, and I'm totally here for that. This was a Robbie Reyes sort of short story. It drew my attention to the fact that Robbie hasn't had a solo title to himself in quite a while. Traditionally, Robbie's series didn't last very long, his original run making it to 12 issues. He had some minis after that, so Robbie hasn't really had the best publishing history on his own. But the more I thought about recent Robbie stories, there's of course been the ongoing 50 plus issue narrative of Robbie's evolution as not just a hero, but as a being of great mystical power in the pages of Jason Aaron's Avengers and Avengers Forever. As I thought about where else I've seen Robbie lately, it occurred to me that it was mostly in the Marvel Voices Comunidad's special. So I'm kind of starting to realize that because there is such a big picture at work gearing Robbie into the central working cogs of what Jason Aaron is doing with his Avengers and the Celestials, which is of course leading into this summer's upcoming Kieran Gillen-led Acts, right? Avengers, X-Men, Eternals, which I'm really hoping for, I'm really positive on. Kieran Gillen taking on an event like this. It's a creator who loves these characters. So it just really seems like the right fit for me here. But outside of that big Jason Aaron Avengers narrative, it feels as though a lot of Robbie's stories are sort of being controlled in sort of this holding pattern. In many ways, that makes a lot of sense. Robbie represents something so important to the Marvel brand. He's a cool, modern, attractive, hip Latino, and I don't just mean that he's physically attractive. This is an attractive package for a character. He is so about his younger brother who has a visible disability as a person living with an invisible disability, seeing this sort of representation, and the fact that the date is Gabe's date with Gabe's crush normalizes Gabe's experience as a young man living with a disability and says he's still worthy of love. So, I mean, this book did a whole lot of things very right for me. But of course, that did make me kind of realize that Gabe has been at the heart of so many of Robbie's recent stories, and I get it, because Robbie is the good guy older brother that stayed around. He's a superhero, but he's taking care of his younger family. And that's so in line with so many of our heroes who have sidekicks. It's just this sidekick doesn't also fight crime. And in that regard, Robbie Reyes has so much riding on him that Marvel using his character very carefully and intelligently is really represented in where they're placing him while still keeping him in books every month. And speaking of every month, it kind of has felt a little bit like there's been a Holiday Infinity comic like every month. And I'm a big holiday guy. I love reasons to celebrate and be happy, right? So even if it's not my holiday, I'm so happy that Marvel is doing these because, hey, now I get to learn a little bit more about it and I get to celebrate, and that's so exciting. And as I was looking back, it turns out that we've only missed one holiday special before this, and that was the first holiday special Marvel published, the Mighty Marvel Holiday Special, Halloween with the Rhino Infinity Comic, written by Ryan North, with pencils and inks by Tom Riley, colors by Chris O'Halloran, and letters by VC's Joe Sabino. This story was really a cleverly thought out, emotionally impactful narrative. Ultimately, the Rhino wants to do right, and he's trying to look after kids on Halloween. As he's doing this, he sees some kids parading around as Spider-Man and feels that Spider-Man is encroaching on his good guy-ness for the night, and the voices in his head do start to get to him. I probably don't love all of the representations of dissociative identity and the sorts of representations of mental health, some of which, you know, directly does affect me in a very personal way. So sometimes I think that these conventions of the storytelling, right? This is not about Ryan North. This is a convention of the storytelling where people have good voice, bad voice, and they manifest it. Sometimes it is a little bit about the simplicity of explaining good and evil to children. And that is definitely something that comes across in this book. I think more than ever, these Marvel Infinity comics, as we're going to talk about in our Spider-Bot coverage later this episode, they're geared toward being able to hand them to your younger cousin, to your nephew or niece, and say, hey, this is for you. You're going to love this. Check out this awesome Spider-Man thing. Check out this other cool character you maybe never heard of before. Certainly, some of these titles don't lend themselves to that. And that would perhaps be titles like X-Men Unlimited, which doesn't just cover heavy topics, but is certainly entrenched in the narrative of Krakoa at all times. The Rhino story sees Rhino come up against these kids when, just in time, Spider-Man swings in. And Spider-Man, along with these children, are enough to scare Rhino into believing he's out-spidered and out-manned. Through the course of that, they're able to talk Alexei down and get him to realize that this isn't what he wants to be, and he shouldn't let his darker demons shout him down. From there, he heads home that night and writes in his journal that he wants to be a good man the next day, inspired by Spider-Man. What could have been as simple as 9 panels and the joke had been, man, that Rhino is a dummy, turned into a powerful story about a compelling desire to be better the next day, no matter what you were like the day before. And with that as a central narrative behind the kind of story that we're aiming toward our children, right, in these Infinity comics, I think Marvel has a really strong handle on what they're doing, right, because they're taking that idea of kind of the hokey comic classic narrative, but they're updating it in a way where Spider-Man was still here. He still saved the day. These kids never tried to take on the Rhino, so there was still sort of the responsible element of telling the kids not to get directly involved, yet there was still sort of a psychological component. And if we're boiling these sorts of complicated psychologies down so that kids can appreciate them and can learn from them, I can be pretty okay with the representation of mental health here. Jumping forward to Ghost Rider and the most recent Marvel Infinite Holiday comic, this was not just a pleasure for me to read as a Ghost Rider fan, but again, I was so happy to see the normalization of a character who lives with a disability thriving romantically. This story was brought to us by Jason Liu, Alba Glez, Lebeau Underwood, Walden Wong, Carlos Lopez, and VC's Joe Sabino on writing, penciling, inking, color, art, and lettering, respectively. Right, that might be the most credits we have ever had on one of these Marvel Infinity comics, but kind of makes sense because I think this is like the longest title ever. It's Mighty Marvel Holiday Special Ghost Riding to Love Infinity Comic. Now, this story sees our boy Robbie Reyes convinced, not very much convincing required, by the way, because he's such a good guy, to take his wonderful brother Gabe out for the perfect Valentine's date with his study partner. Now, I love the sort of conventions of coming of age this allows Gabe to have. With his study partner, Charlene Ocampo, he wants to have the ultimate multi-Valentine's Day date, or the UMVDD. And they just want to go do glow-in-the-dark mini-golf, go to the arcade, and have nachos. This is such a realistic, humanizing thing. These are eighth graders who are, like, they can't stop saying that they're in love, and that's just such an eighth grade thing. And something that we've talked about a lot on this show is, while it's important to normalize the coming of age and growing up experience, it's also important not to, like, hypersexualize every character in a comic. And there is certainly a balance of allowing these characters to experience necessary and proper emotional coming of age without any sort of, like, well, now Gabe's a grown up, right? The thing that this highlighted for me in so many ways is that you can still have the story be about the way in which Robbie is there for Gabe and have Robbie provide for Gabe emotionally without taking Robbie out of the narrative. This is still all about Robbie being the Ghost Rider. Even when he's kind of just being the Ghost Riding chauffeur, he's still very much an active part of this story. A lot of the humor does make me kind of like giggle and kind of roll my eyes. I do sometimes find that when I introduce myself to anybody, you know, under the age of 18, they're immediately like, sir, Mr. Sir. And it's very funny to see Robbie be like, please stop calling me Tito. Like, I don't need that. Please stop. It's just so cute. And one of the things that's really important to me is that by having Robbie have that experience with Charlene, where she calls him uncle in Tagalog, it's so significant because she doesn't call him uncle in any sort of directly like, oh, did I just call you uncle in a Puerto Rican dialect of Spanish? Oh, you know, it's nothing like that. This is clearly the writers and editors at Marvel saying it's totally cool to see other cultural representation in a title that you might expect to see one cultural representation in. And that sort of progressive multi-inclusivity is the thing that makes Robbie Reyes's Ghost Rider such a great vehicle for this. He's such a good guy. He's so accessible. It's not outside of the realm that a guy from the neighborhood might know some people who have some other cultures. And I think that is such a significant point in not hammering this at people. Not being like, look at our multicultural celebration here at Multicultural Day at school. This is about creating a harmonious discussion where people feel comfortable discussing their culture throughout their daily experience. And I really think hats off to Jason Liu for creating a narrative that not just supports that, but where the dialogue feels pretty natural. A lot of stories like this, the dialogue can get kind of clunk, especially when you're trying to give kids a realistic sound, right? That's always a little tricky. But I think Jason Liu does a really good job keeping it clear that this is from the perspective of vaguely adults talking about viewing this experience. Now, Jason Liu, we recently covered over in the pages of X-Men Unlimited for X-Men Unlimited number 21, Downtime. And that is, of course, an X-Men comic, and Jason Liu is here doing a Ghost Rider comic, which sees the inclusion of Arcade. Now, I want to point out that I love this The Darkness hair that Arcade is rocking. He looks phenomenal. That perm is everything for me, 1,000%. But it's a little unusual that Arcade is here. Robbie Reyes doesn't exactly have the world's most developed rogues gallery, so I'm not saying that, oh, there was 1,000 better Arcade-based villains that made more sense for Robbie Reyes. No, just like, it was a little random to see Arcade here, especially because he didn't have a whole lot to do. He shows up, kind of stands at the top of a staircase, and then just kind of gets his ass kicked later on. I'm fine with that, you know. Arcade is one of my favorite villains of all time, so I love that this now has a canonical moment where I can point back and be like, look, so if Arcade ever shows up, maybe Robbie can show up, because now they've got a rivalry. Like, I'm going to stretch it as long as I can. But the most significant thing about this story for me was that it reminded me that what we have been calling for on this show since day one, slice of life stories, do have a place, not just in the Marvel Universe, but in our regular comic reading. I don't always want to read Robbie Reyes pushed to the limits of his life. That isn't always a comfortable experience for me as someone who loves this character. I want to see these characters not just survive, I want to see them flourish. And by giving me an opportunity to see Robbie just be a good brother, not be a good brother while facing down the Celestials. No, yeah, he stopped Arcade, but like, it's Arcade. Just unplug the machine. He's defeated. Oh no, right? So I feel like this is really the kind of story I would hand to somebody and say, hey, you want to get to know Robbie Reyes a little bit better? Read this. This is, of course, not the quintessential Robbie Reyes story. This is not the same thing as handing somebody Life of Wolverine and saying, hey, check this out. You're going to get a really great sense of the character that you can run with forever. But if your goal is to continue getting someone you love into comics through characters that they may recognize from something like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., like Robbie Reyes, where he was played by the amazing Gabriel Luna, or, you know, if it's Spider-Bot, because you've got a young engineer that you want to inspire, you want them to see the sort of ideas of advanced robotics in their comics. Marvel Unlimited really is providing a lot for me right now. I do sometimes find that my Unlimited read is a little bit more enjoyable than my weekly, like, poll, right? So it's not that, like, no one's sponsoring this. This is just, you know, I really do think this is worth the read, especially if you're a Robbie Reyes fan, if you're an Infinity Comics fan, or if you just want to see the difference between an Infinity comic and an Infinite comic. Check out the Robbie Reyes Christmas special and compare it to this. You can get a really strong sense of how they are trying to make these a bit more accessible and, in many ways, a lot less of a process to read. So hopefully you guys pick this up and you enjoy. But now let's move on to another title here at X's for Podcast. When we started covering Moon Knight, it was because, you know, kind of a threefold thing. Number one, we love Jed MacKay. Jed MacKay not only came over and did an amazing interview with us where he helped us to understand his process as a writer and a lot of the decisions he makes with these characters, but Moon Knight's a character that we're all sort of rooting for in the upcoming revisioning that's going to inevitably happen following Oscar Isaac's upcoming TV show. And it somehow went from, yeah, I mean, we're going to cover it because those and its content. To if I tried to tell this crew that they couldn't cover this book, I don't even know what would happen. There would be a mutiny here on X's for Podcast. So we sure hope you guys enjoy our coverage of Moon Knight number 8 just as much as this team enjoys the title itself. And if you guys like what you hear, don't forget, you might even like what you see. So don't forget to give us a subscribe over on Twitter and Instagram at X's for Podcast.
Thank you. Hey, everybody, welcome to another exciting segment of X's for Podcast, where we talk about mutants, magics, and Marvel week after week. I'm Nathan. You can find me online at DazzlerAOA on Twitter. That's Dazzler, like in the Age of Apocalypse.
Hi, everyone. This is Juancho, and you can find me on Twitter at Lost in Krakow, and we're so excited for you to get mooned with us.
Yes.
That was so perfect.
That was perfect.
And hello, I'm Steve. It's me. And you can find me on Twitter at Howdy Duda. It's HOWDYDUDA.
And I'm Raven, aka Dame Red Bento. And you can find me over on Twitter and Instagram sometimes. Come over, start a conversation. I've got plenty of things to say.
We are talking about Moon Knight number 8 today. Moon Knight is brought to us by our writer, Jed McKay, our artist, Alessandro.
He's back and we miss him.
Our color artist, Rochelle Rosenberg, always amazing. Our letterer is BC's Corey Pettit.
Just like, if anyone at Marvel is listening to us, can you fix the cover? Because it says Capuccio, not Capuccio.
Oh, it does.
Oh my gosh, it does.
Hey, yeah, good call out. Thank you. I think sometimes Mr. McKay listens in, so hopefully that can be a thing that's resolved later.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So,
good catch.
Was anybody else a little thrown by the fact that The Devil's Reign Moon Knight hasn't come out? And we're kind of find out what happens a little bit in there.
Yeah, that was interesting. And this is a Moon Knight Devil's Reign tie-in, but it's not Devil's Reign Moon Knight number one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was weird. I think being fair to them, it's probably just like a paper thing or like schedules got messed up.
Yeah.
Devil's Reign Moon Knight is coming out in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So must have been some confusion, maybe.
Honestly, it works here because unlike a lot of tie-ins or events, this is nice because since there's another Fist of Khonshu, that we just get to do his little backup story, which would have been coming anyway. We needed to get a character piece designed on this character that we don't know much about yet, and it came at exactly the right moment, and it works because Moon Knight is off doing something else in another comic we'll read later. I think
Khonshu has two fists. I really loved this change of pace, as it were. I'm sorry, I'm just drooling over this outfit. I'm loving it. And it's that beautiful inverse to the Mr. Moon versus Dr. Moon, that stark white outfit versus this black outfit. And the body structure is wonderfully different. So you can definitely tell it is a different person, not the same person.
It's clearly not like a palette swapped version of Moon Knight. It is like that's Dr. Botter in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought the contrast worked really well, not just visually, but yeah, like we've been seeing Dr. Vader like become a character, and I really like that we got an issue to flesh him out even more.
Yeah,
and it's like you said, a nice change of pace.
Mm-hmm. It's cool that he has a similar like drive to Moon Knight, and that like you know the circumstances of his death continue to drive his motivations and he feels he needs to atone for things that he's done, but like obviously they're very different, you know, like Moon Knight did a lot of his killing of innocents before he became Moon Knight, whereas for Dr. Botter it's a lot of it is afterwards, and there's just like nice parallels and inverses, and their relationship with Khonshu, which we'll definitely be getting into, is so distinct and comes into play in this issue.
We gotta do it every time because it's so good. Rochelle Rosenberg's colors are just out of this world, this issue. With like the suit, and we're gonna go to that later on with the fight between Dr. Vader and Stainless Scarlet.
Those pages,
the colors in those pages were incredible.
Those pages are completely unbelievable. I was also struck by the lamp between Dr. Vader and Mr. Flint.
Yeah. Or even if you're looking at page 6 of Digital, which has Hunter Moon out there and the moon, just the way the moon is reflecting, like.
Yeah, the black suit really gives this different vibe, and it's the colors work so well in this issue. Mm-hmm. Also, we should shout out Corey Pettit because the letters for Stainless Scarlet were really good, I think.
Like
the bubbles had a different shape to them, besides like the colors being red and yellow. Like the word bubbles had a like a little weird squiggly pattern.
That texture to them.
Going back to the beginning of the issue, the scene Nathan mentioned where Hunter's Moon is on a roof, and it's that classic scene we get every single issue of Moon Knight silhouetted against the moon. And I love that it's a full moon, of course, because it's a Hunter's Moon.
It's always a full moon.
Well, I feel like it's always a crescent moon out when it's Moon Knight. Like he only goes out on the crescent moon nights.
I love the fact that they are aware of the very different moons that these two represent, because Moon Knight is the very classic crescent moon. He is, you know, all in white, but he's got that big crescent moon, whereas Hunter's moon is a full moon. That is exactly what a Hunter's moon is. You need enough moonlight that you can actually hunt the prey that you're looking for, and a full moon is the only time you can really do that. So I love the fact that that is a conscious yet tiny detail that they keep track on. I'm like, oh, this is they've done their research. I love it.
Honestly, we should. I'm gonna go back and read all the issues just to see if the moon lines up.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure it is almost always like a nearly impossible crescent moon in some of those, like a hangnail moon.
How did we feel about the sort of therapy session that Hunter's Moon was getting from Mr. Flint? You know, usually we have Mark in Dr. Sturman, but this time we had Hunter's Moon, you know, sort of maybe not therapy session, but confessional, however you want to call it, with Mr. Flint. What do we think about that relationship?
I'm going to say that I felt like the therapy session in this issue was not here, but at the end. Mm-hmm. This was more like a regular, you know, detective goes for help, like Detective Gordon asks Batman for help.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very much so.
Kind of very, very Gordon kind of feel.
Yeah.
The thing about Flint is that he did get fired just because of Moon Knight, because it was recorded on camera, Moon Knight's brutal intervention during a hostage situation in a World Trade Center. So after that, Flint was fired as a... And yeah, Flint did appear in Moon Knight 12, and Scarlet Fascinera appeared in Moon Knight 14 of that same run. So like they're so tied together by their time period. I love that we're actually getting a rich tapestry for Moon Knight to kind of dive into. Like that's his own versus where we've had some great, cool, odd one-shot characters, but now we're actually getting some lore into Moon Knight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to say one of the favorite parts of this run is that we're actually getting to become like a Moon Knight sort of rogue gallery that we didn't really have before.
Yeah,
these are characters that are intrinsically tied to Moon Knight.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Like Zodiac and Stained Glass Scarlet and Dr. Butter at first represent like a really nice, like these are unique characters to this world. And it's a world that doesn't really interact unless with like, you know, his friend Tigra, who isn't really tied to any other book. I like that. I think you're right. It needs a rogues gallery, and it's starting to develop its own like system of allies and villains.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Supposed to say Dracula or vampires, because they appear all over Marvel.
Yeah.
These characters that are very just tied to Moon Knight. Mm-hmm.
And Jason Aaron put through a really interesting twist on the Vampire Nation recently, so I wonder...
Did anyone get, like, a Zodiac vibe in this issue? Was it just me?
Just a little
like
bit,
the spray painting and the serial killing, yeah.
Yeah.
Not Zodiac, the character from the past issue.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, it did have a very, like, serial killer-esque vibe to it. And, I mean, everybody's spray painting these red S's right around where there's, like, a little candlelight visual kind of area, so you could tell that people have begun putting their faith in something other than, you know, just a pristine church with its order. This is much more people in desperate need have set up a candlelight vigil in an alleyway, basically. And yeah, it's got a super like serial killer kind of vibe to it, but I'm here for it.
I like that they went like all out with this whole mystic occult aspect to it.
Yes.
I know Steve loved
Yes, I was so excited by this issue. Like that, she's not
like 100%.
Mm-hmm. I thought that it might be like a Scooby Doo where she was going to turn out to be like a human who died, and I was like, oh no, she's a giant stained glass god now. That's fucking cool.
Yeah,
like that single page, the single splash page where she's standing with all four of her arms out, holding the crossbow and the knife, and with the crown over her head is like so gorgeous, incredibly beautiful.
Page. What I loved about this battle is it really brought to mind some really classic Morrison Doom Patrol runs, like where like Scarlet Fascinera, Stained Glass Scarlet, really to me had the appearance of Lodestone after Lodestone awakened from the coma. Just this whole idea of this transformation from death is just so amazing. What do we think about the central thought behind this battle? The power of words, the power of thought.
I have been waiting for something more mystical to happen with Moon Knight, because they're constantly talking about, oh, I serve the god Khonshu, oh, the god Khonshu. While I love the action and, you know, mayhem that they get into, I was like waiting for like the mysticism aspect to play a little bit more heavily into the storylines, and I think this is so perfect.
A vengeful spirit in a bloody church, like wreaking vengeance that she never would have in life. I love the meta-narrative on stories. I always love that kind of stuff. I'm a sucker for that Neil Gaiman bullshit. I love that we deal with Botter's atonement, and he's just like, I have changed, you know, like, I know I did wrong, but like, I can grow, can you? My favorite part is that him just talking about, like, I was blinded by my own hatred. I'm a fish of Khonshu, but I'm also a person. A person may change, learn, kind of story. It was so powerful. He looks like such a badass. It's very cool.
I love his line. Securing himself. To your point, when he says that, like, a person can change, and it's just kind of story change or something along those lines. And that was like a perfect counter to what Stingless Scarlet was saying.
Yes.
Yep. I mean, the dialogue in this issue was, in this battle specifically, was, I mean, it was a bit sort of heavy-handed, but I thought, like, for a Marvel comic, it was really, really good.
I thought it was very well-balanced. Yes. Yeah. It had a meter to it that really sang.
Yeah, like, it read really, really well. And, I mean, I don't really, like, know much about like Bible lores, stuff like that, like in the mystics part. So maybe you can shed some light on it. The first line is from Isaiah 41:10. Mm-hmm. Like, do not fear, for I am with you, and for I am your God, and I will strengthen you, and all that. Mm-hmm. And the second line is, I mean, the beginning of John's gospel, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very interesting. So Stainglass was playing from this sort of Judeo-Christian angle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Hunter's Moon was playing, which is something that we see a lot, like in faith, was playing with this older religion, which is like Egyptian religion. Like, it's something older. And that's what he said. People have been believing in stories about hunters in the night and creatures of the night.
And the power of the moon.
And the power of the moon and the sun and all that, for far longer than people have been believing in like the Judeo-Christian God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was like some sort of nice ideas that Jay was playing with.
I really like that. Hunter's Moon is differentiated primarily from Moon Knight by his actual faith in the God.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they both know this God is real. I'm not talking about the like faith in his existence, but like the faith in him as a protector and as a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
I was most struck in this issue by that crazy splash 2 pages.
Whoa, yeah.
We've seen Khonshu in Moon Knight before, and like we've also seen Moon Knight appearing as like a Khonshu style figure that's terrifying and large, but I feel like it's never been on this scale, and I think that speaks to how not only is Dr. Botter's god and story older and more powerful and more entrenched than this new urban legend of Stained Glass Scarlet, but like also his Khonshu is a bigger god than Moon Knight's Khonshu. Like, he's a bigger, more terrifying and stronger god.
Yeah, and the outfit different too.
Yes.
Well, yeah, and it's based on their, yeah, the weight of their faith. Like, Mark Spector's faith in Khonshu is like, yeah, I get that you exist, but I don't exactly love you. So he doesn't put everything into it. Whereas Bader, on the other hand, puts everything into it. And you can tell just by the size and structure and strength of the Khonshu that he brings forward. I'm like, dude, I love that there's different representations of Khonshu based on who's manifesting the image.
Yeah.
And it makes sense.
We see like this sort of council of Moon Knights down below.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just that battle between Stainless Scarlet right there and Khonshu. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, the lines are super precise. I love all the like broken glass along the edges of skin on Stainless Scarlet's hands, that cool like floating crown. Everything about this sequence is like extremely exquisite. It feels like I'm watching like a really action oriented anime sometimes, like when I'm in the middle of this book and immersed in it, because it just feels like there's so much action going on. There's so many flowing capes and flying glass. And Dr. Potter is so confident and cool in his disposition. Like, he is such a completely different kind of Fist of Khonshu.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something I noticed about the glass is that, as opposed to other issues in this run where like the action is very, like the onomatopoeic sounds are very present.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue just had, there's two. One, crush, and then like the glass falling, ting, ting, ting. ding, ding, like that.
Yeah.
But I could hear that glass falling the rest of the issue, even though I didn't have the sounds.
Yes.
Yes.
On the page. And I think that works a lot. That adds to this issue's like immersion. Like I was
very
immersed in this fight.
That's something I'm noticing throughout the series now, is that the sound effects are very restrained and minimalist. Like they're there when you need a good clonk from a baseball bat. That's true.
Yeah.
While I of course miss that and would love for it to come back anytime. It's not needed most of the time. And when it's not needed, it makes room for the art, like you were saying. Also, I just noticed that there's a crescent moon over Khonshu towards the end when he's fighting Stained Glass Scarlet. I wonder why that wasn't a full moon, but there's some crescent moon.
Well, I mean, the moon is always changing. So we do see some representations of the full moon. Sometimes we see the representations of the crescent moon. Yeah. I would love to know if these other moon nights are different representations of the moon. So like,
yeah, when are we going to get new moon?
Waxing the gibbous. Yeah. Oh, the half moon. I love this restrained use of the sound effects, like you said, because you can tell when it transitions from being this physical reality to something that is more extra planar. When he hits the ground, it's because he fell literally through the roof, through the stained glass, and hit floor. And then, you know, he saw just this big figure. And so, of course, he kicks it. And I think he actually shattered real glass. And then, yeah, just you see that the way she coalesces and the sound effects go away, so you can kind of feel that transition into something that's extra planar or on a slightly different dimension. But yeah, the way all of the little shards of glass are drawn, you can kind of still hear that the sound effect is in there, but you don't have the sound effect pulling your eye away from what is happening. And it is so gorgeously done.
And I think it's amazing that almost all the little panes of glass are individually colored. Or like, you can tell there's a gradient there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's some red, there's some yellow, some orange,
purple,
some purple. Like they're actually reflecting what's going. Like they're reflecting either Stained Glass Scarlet or they're reflecting Khonshu. And I think that's just incredible.
Yeah,
that's Rachel Rosenberg. It's so good. Like I feel like going back to what you said, Steve, about this feeling like an anime fight. I would say this felt to me more like the end of a JRPG where you kill God.
I do love the fact that Khonshu himself says that he can't be killed, nor can he kill her. She's a new god, you know? And he's like, I can't destroy you. I can knock you down a peg. I can, you know, make it so you cannot function for a while. But I can't kill you because your story is already out there. You already have followers and faith. I'm not here to destroy you. I'm here to knock you down for a bit, you know, and let you rethink.
Yep. We even see somebody at the end of the issue come to as another supplicant to Stained Glass Scarlet's cult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it goes back to this whole power of words thing that I mentioned before the fight. Isn't that an idea? Like,
what I loved about this issue is it totally shifted, at least, if not the series, at least Hunter's Moon is a character who can handle these more broader notions, these bigger ideas than just the street level villains that we've seen.
Every single issue has been tightly plotted and has had like a self-contained story that's like a vignette or an episode that gives us further insight onto characters and the themes of why they interact with the other characters in the book, and constantly hammering home on questions of theology and the power of like stories and belief. And it has just never let up on that. And I think that's something that takes a lot of skill.
I thought the epilogue was going to be following up on the Zodiac plotline. So far, like the main villain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get any of that. So I think just playing us here, like what happened to the Doctor and what happened to Zodiac, you got to wait 2 months to find out, or even more.
This person who we thought might be Zodiac but isn't, Rutherford Winner. I did a little bit of quick digging this morning because I didn't even notice the name on the door the first time I read it through. He was a victim of a Hydra program called Project Pygmalion that turned regular people into Hydra killers. And he has some kind of connection with Andrea Sturman.
I was reading the Marvel Wiki last night. And so Rutherford Winner has only appeared like 2 times.
In the Daughters of the Dragon.
In Daughters of the Dragon by Jed McKay.
In Jed McKay's Daughter of the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting that we get another, like, continuing this whole serial killer vibe.
Yes.
I mean, Zodiac in a Zodiac story. But now we got another Zodiac killer into the mix. Mm-hmm. With a guy that killed like 40 people.
Thematically, we're getting a lot of serial killers.
Yes.
And a lot of serial killers that have appeared either in previous Moon Knight or in previous Jed McKay works. So I like that he's pulling them all together as like you said, like an actual rogues gallery.
Yeah.
All I know is that security guard has definitely lost his frickin' job.
the serial killers become their own legend, their own story. And it feels like that's what Zodiac is trying to achieve, to become this epic legend on a stained glass scarlet level. But maybe he's never going to do it because nobody's going to care that much about him.
We know that Zodiac is trying to like break Moon Knight and build him up again.
Okay.
And what's a way that you break people? You break their belief system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Break their spirit.
Break their worldview. This is a very interesting contrast if Zodiac succeeds, because if Moon Knight were to like dig deep into his belief, he would become sort of like Hunter's Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a contrast of going full belief into Khonshu and Zodiac's going like zero belief in Khonshu, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that's maybe going to come, that's going to play with later.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a tension set up pretty much immediately, like almost in maybe even the first couple of issues, really, between the two of them, how they have such interesting and different goals for their relationship with Moon Knight.
Yeah, so, and this was just like a visual representation of the power of Dr. Vader's belief in Khonshu. We only heard of it, now we've been shown it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it. I love that we're getting more depth and more nuance, and we're not just going to remain on that kind of, to me, what's been the kind of basic level of, okay, we're, you know, street level crime. It's all good. It's street level crime. I'm like, I like the street level crime, and I love the storyline that's been going on, but I've been kind of like, I've been itching for a little bit more, and this issue gave me that little bit more. I'm like Wancho said, there's that difference between Mark Spencer has like zero faith in Khonshu. He openly despises him, but he, you know, he's stuck because, oh yeah, that's right, I kind of made a deal with this god and I cannot get out of that, so here I am. Yeah. Versus Bader.
He's like, I was crossing my fingers.
Right. I was lying. Didn't mean it. You know, takesy-backsy.
Chris Bader.
Where Bader is like full in. He is a very devout believer who has also very much retained his own personhood, his bodily autonomy. And he's like, I'm here because I actually have faith in this entity, and I want to give, you know, my service to them versus having to give their service to them.
The cover for this issue,
Corey Smith and Rachel Rosenberg.
It's after the Steve McNiven Moon Knight number one, the first issue of this run. Identical in almost all respects, like he's standing on the same like statuary gargoyle in the rain, and I thought that was so cool. Like it is definitely a great homage to the first issue of the same run, and it draws further parallels between their action here. This is like number one of Hunter's Moon.
One thing that jumps out to me is that in the Moon Knight number one cover by Steve McNiven, Moon Knight's outfit is all torn up and like shredded.
Yes.
Versus the outfit from Hunter's Moon is like just wet.
Yeah, just wet. It's pristine.
And the eyes, I really like how the eyes contrast, because Moon Knight's eyes are blue and Hunter's Moon eyes are like orangey.
Same with the lightning. We get the blue lightning and now yellow, like brighter lightning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
The buildings are different too. They're actually inverse.
Mm-hmm.
Like Moon Knight's eyes and thunders are like blue, and the windows in the building are orange, and then the other cover is backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Real life parallel to those two. Like everything's inverse between these two.
It is so well thought out.
It's
fantastic. Yeah. I have an homage cover, and I'll have to throw these up later on Twitter.
But I like that this is like an actual character that's a counterpoint to Moon Knight. Not opposed to Moon Knight, but what if Moon Knight were different?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a sort of what if scenario, but like...
But being played in real time.
It's another path that the Fish of Khonshu could have been, and is.
I love it.
Like, it's not like... They just didn't do a palette swap for the counterpoint. They actually thought out everything.
Yes.
From belief systems to actual origin of the character.
Personality.
Like, trying to fix some of these more problematic elements of Moon Knight being, like, the chosen one of an Egyptian god. And actually going for an Egyptian dude to be the counterpoint, right?
It would be honestly totally cool and okay with me if Dr. Vader became like a legacy Moon Knight and Mark Spector retired at some point.
I'd be okay with that.
I would not hate that.
Now Mark Spector's never going to release the title just because of the MCU version.
So yeah.
I don't know. But it's interesting that we're getting, and I don't know how that's going to tie in. We're going to see. But we're getting this Moon Knight Red, White, and Blood thing, right?
Right.
By Jonathan Hickman and others. And and they said that this is like a Moon Knight from the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the solicits. So I'm very interested to see how that ties into this run, if it ever ties in. I hope it does. I like the way because that would be very interesting to see. Not just because it's Hickman, but because Moon Knight's nobody's really thought of Moon Knight as being able to have a legacy version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now we actually have a legacy version, just in a different costume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So far.
And we saw all those Moon Knights represented. God, I love how you pointed that out, because yeah, that sets us up to get legacy stories and to get mantle changes. Because I mean, I think we've always known that the Moon Knight is a mantle and not just this singular person.
Yeah, and going back to that page, Raven, I mean, I don't know the shadows because they're just, we don't know the colors, but all the Moon Knights except for Hunter's Moon are just in white.
Mm.
So if Hunter's Moon, like something new that's conscious trying out,
yeah,
are there other Hunter's Moons out there?
I thought these were interesting because like they're not... They're all dressed differently, you know? But Moon Knight currently also dresses more like Hunter's Moon than any of those other Moon Knights.
Yeah.
Yes, I would love to see, you know, female, male, non-binary. I would love to see the whole gamut because, yeah, it's not a concept, a devotion of religion that is just male-centered. Like, look at how many different representations of the moon that we have across mythology and how many of them fall into female or goddesses or even animal spirits or non-binary representations because of the way the moon changes. So I would love to see like a wide spectrum of representation.
Yeah, Raven, you're spot on there, because if there's one thing that represents everything, like the moon changes constantly, it should be Moon Knight that reflects that.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Moon Knight should not be just restricted to like... I mean, I'm glad that it's not no longer just like for a white dude, but it's like for people too. And... yeah, like the moon has so many different aspects. That should be reflected in who the moon chooses to be the representative for protectors in the night.
Mm-hmm.
So what did we think about the budding relationship that is growing between Hunter's Moon and Reese? And how do we think it's going to affect the relationship with Mark when he comes back inevitably?
Well, you say budding relationship, but it's really him like being like, sorry, I tried to kill you. I don't think I ever said sorry. Like, it's fine, but it's not fine.
Is that? I mean, no.
Yeah. But like, that's growth.
Yes.
Yeah. So Butter's actually growing as a character in these 8 issues.
Mm-hmm.
And like, him willing to say sorry to Reese is a first step. Might not be the biggest step, but it's the first one.
It's honestly pretty surprising. Like, not that I think the worst of Badr, but like Badr has like shown himself to be kind of surprising every issue that he's come out. Like, you know, from his extremely devout, like, I will not listen to you attitude at the beginning to like admitting he was wrong, and now to actually like apologizing and being very kind. It's nice how quick he can turn around on that. And sometimes I wonder if we just maybe caught Badr on a bad day on his first appearance, you know?
I think it's also a bit playing on this idea of people. I'm not sure if sellout is the right word here, but like, you know how people can be super deeply entrenched into their religion.
Yes.
That they refuse to hear anything else. And I think that's sort of what Dr. Butter's journey is going through. That we know conscience done some questionable things, and like, you should not believe 100% into something that does what conscience has done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's sort of like this first step. I mean, like, Mark and Dr. Butter are on opposite journeys.
Yeah.
Like, from Zero, it feels like they're going to meet in the middle regarding Khonshu and their roles, like, going forward.
Yeah.
And this, Dr. Butter's first step into maybe Khonshu is not always perfectly right all the time.
Yeah, okay. I loved the very brief but poignant interaction between Reese and Bader. Because Reese put herself, honestly, on the line searching out Bader, because Bader had already tried to friggin' kill her. But to, like, go and find the one person that could do what needed to be done, that takes some guts to do. And I like the fact that they don't just make her forgive him, because that is a trope that has fallen into far too often is, oh, if I say I'm sorry, you'll just forgive me. And it's like, no, you tried to kill my ass. Like, you really tried to kill
my ass. Yeah, that's going to take time.
Yeah. And she says that. It's like, no, we're not okay. You tried to freaking murder me. It's going to take a little time.
Yeah, between this and New Mutants, it's been a week for complicated stories of forgiveness.
Yes. Yeah. and I'm here for it. I actually am really, really here for it. Because forgiveness isn't an easy thing. Forgiveness isn't something that, you know, oh, if I say I'm sorry, I should just, you know, up and forgive you. I mean, there are some not so nice people who use that technique all the time. Well, oh, you know, you have to forgive me. No, I don't. I don't. If your apology is just for you, then it's just for you. I don't have to do shit. Thank you very much. Or sure. Sometimes, you know, it's just something that takes time. Like, okay, I hear your apology. I'm still going to need to take some time on that because there's a lot to work through. So I loved it. I love this entire team. I will admit, when I first heard that I was going to be reading Moon Knight, I'm like, okay. I guess I can. And now I'm just like, oh my god, when's the next one coming out? Oh god, so tell me I'm on the review team because this is so good.
Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly. It's so good.
Love the idea of the stained glass Scarlet, the Scarlet Fascinera, continuing on in that amazing fashion. And just that little symbol of hope for people out there to
get their enemies killed.
Yeah, get their enemies killed. And, you know, yeah. Our epilogue does introduce the, like we did say, the winner Rutherford, who's going to hopefully be in that next issue. And we're going to find out more about him from his two issue appearance.
Rutherford winner.
I think
he's Rutherford got a last winner. Name for a first name.
Oh, Rutherford winner.
Very yeah. Awesome.
Don't worry.
So that implies there's a Rutherford loser, right?
Oh, man.
His code name should be the winner takes it all.
The winner soldier.
The winner soldier?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, guys. So, Nico here one last time. Marvel Unlimited Spider-Bots. This Spider-Bot series is too cute to be real, which is, of course, number one. Clearly, this was meant to be an accessible, adorable title that you could just pick up. But it also is worth mentioning that this is a follow-up to Web of Spider-Man, W.E.B., a series that ran in late 2021, which featured the origin of the precious Spider-Bots, who do, as we mentioned at the end of the segment, appear over at Avengers Campus at Disneyland, where they are available, evidently, according to our team. So you're going to have to go check that out in Disneyland yourself. But hopefully you guys enjoy our coverage of Spider-Bot just as much as we enjoyed covering the Spider-Bot Infinity comic. We love making this show for you 3 times a week every week, with usually Magic Mondays, X-Men X Wednesdays, and Marvel Fanfare Fridays. So until next time, enjoy this last segment. Keep those Krakoan gateways open, those mutant lights lit. Remember, it's not a comic unless it's unlimited, I guess. I'm Nico. You guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction. We'll see you next time.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back for another exciting segment of X's for Podcast, a show where we cover Marvel Mutants and Robot Poker Nights over here on the internet. I'm your host, Jonah, and you can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at PeakJonah. That's P-E-A-K.
I'm Tori. You can find me on Twitter at Tori _ Sheehan and on Instagram at SMTori. That's Tori with an I.
I'm Kevo. You can find me over on the socials at Kevo Really, KevoReally.
And I'm Jake, they, them. You can find me at Twitter, Omega Sentinel, OH Mega Sentinel. And we hope you survive the experience, unlike any enemy of the Spider-Bot. Yes.
Absolutely. Spider-Bot's enemies come crushing down from their adorable cuteness and quick wit. That must mean we're covering the Spider-Bot Infinity Comics numbers 1-6, written by Jordan Blum, art by Alberto Albuquerque, colors by Dono Sanchez Almara, and letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. Now, I need everybody's honest opinions on this. On a scale of cutest thing you've ever seen to cutest thing you've ever seen, how cute do you find these Spider-Bots?
Okay.
I give this 7 squeeze.
I did not expect to think it would be the cutest thing I'd ever seen, but it really is the cutest friggin' thing I've ever seen.
Kevo.
I sort of assumed that it would have to be. They know what they're doing when it comes to the Spider-Man market, and you have to make something as adorable as Peter Parker. So there you have it. I'm just really more surprised than anything else that they are introducing a concept like this so late into the MCU franchise. I would have thought they would have wanted to have these little things running around sooner.
These Spider-Bots are Stark technology, very reminiscent of the relationship between Peter and Tony within the MCU movieverse, where that relationship is very different considering that they've been around and characters that have interacted with each other for years upon years in comics, where this Infinity comic is trying to establish a very similar relationship between these two characters. And with that comes the bonus of Peter getting to use Stark technology. I would love to know everybody's opinions on this idea. It feels like a family-friendly version of the kind of relationship between Peter and the bots, between Peter and Deadpool. Deadpool is not, you know, the most family-friendly character that you can market to everybody. He's very crude. It's Wade. He's very up his own ass, and he's tried many times to get up there by himself. But the way that these spiders are written reminded me of the way that Wade is written, where they almost essentially, now they don't truly break the fourth wall, but in that same vein, they're very snarky and witty in the same way that Wade is. And I would love to know everybody's opinions on this relationship between Peter and these spider bots.
To me, this feels like when you are watching a show that has like a butler character or a house cleaner character, and you get the one-off episode that's just from them, and you realize that there is so much they are not saying because they're in a position of like of servitude, so they can't like whip out the crazy cutesy sassiness all the time. But in their own little episode, like, they are fascinating. And these little guys, I mean, I loved getting to see them have all of that snark that Spider-Man is so well known for, and also just being the most goddamn adorable robot-loving things on the planet.
Yeah, I guess I've been watching a lot of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and I kind of think of them as the Charlie.
I see that.
They're doing all the cleaning and errand running, and they're so put upon. They really lean into that role, too, and snark Peter with that. I like the idea that they are simultaneously like his charges and also his like his employees.
And yet at the same time, much like Charlie work, they love it and they, you know, do everything that they can, whether it's, you know, getting the stupid egg sandwich or it's stuffing themselves into robot suits to make Peter happy. Like,
oh my God, I love
for
that.
As frustrated as they frequently are with their tasks, they still do them.
They do, and that makes them great workers, because they not only enjoy the work, they do it with complaining, and they understand, well, this is my function, and that's what I have to do. That was a very bad sentence.
We are swiftly approaching the point where we're like, you know what, we need some robot liberation in this world.
Well, speaking of robot liberations, what I actually really enjoyed about this Infinity comic is that they don't really skip any beats about these spider bots interacting with the Marvel world at large. Mm-hmm. They interact with so many different characters that are familiar to comic readers, as well as characters that are familiar to people who are bigger fans of other media that involve Marvel characters. Like, for example, my personal favorite issue was Infinity Comic number 4, which was Robot Poker Night, mm-hmm. which had a whole bevy of characters that are expected when someone would say Robot Poker Night, but also characters I wouldn't expect. Like, I did not think there would be Jocasta or Herbie there, but there they are.
I loved seeing Herbie.
It was really nice that Spider-Bot at the end distinguished Warlock as an alien mutant or whatever, and not technically a robot. I was a little hung up on his invitation at first until we clarified that at the end.
I do love when he was being described, Warlock just said, yes, because yeah. He is. All of those things. Warlock is a very interesting character. But were there any standout moments for you guys in terms of characters that these spider bots interacted with?
I mean, the goblin glider.
Yeah.
Like, that was such a lovely
fully issue. Just like Lady and the Tramp, like friends from across the Romeo Juliet split. Like, oh my God, how could you not?
And it was done very sweetly. It wasn't too extra. There wasn't any drama to it. They became friends and they just wanted to spend time together. And whether you can even view it as friends or you can view it as a romance, whatever it is, it's very sweet and adorable.
It also gave me that feel of when the Looney Tunes clock out at the end of the day and then they're just like, oh, hey, yeah. Bro, how you doing?
And they're all friends. Or like the idea of the Mario games all being stage plays and behind the scenes. They're all just actors and Mario and Bowser are actually friends and it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, they play sports together.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the cameos in this were especially interesting, like MODOK's daughter, who I'm only aware of through the MODOK cartoon show on Hulu. So that's a character that I was not expecting to see somewhere like this of all places.
Well, it's Jordan Blum, right? He's one of the co-writers for the MODOK TV show, and he's the writer on this book.
Oh,
I think.
I've been wondering if that show is good, so I guess maybe I should check it out.
It's supposed to be very funny.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she is a character, I believe, introduced in the show.
She was added to the mainstream Marvel Universe as a response to the then upcoming MODOK.
Okay. Mm.
So it's one of those things where they added her like once or twice to the comics, I think, and then suddenly she's in the sitcom, and now we're going
to
see her everywhere, probably.
Oh, very
Phil Coulson too.
I'm okay with that. You know, Harley Quinn is obviously the most famous example of something like that happening, where they introduce a character to the comics solely because of something that happened in television. And it's synergy. It's the whole point of doing these projects and having reciprocity between one form of media and the other, that when you have a great idea in one place, you bring it over to the other. The Spider-Bot concept was introduced in the Disneyland Marvel Park attraction, but I know there's similar stuff that I wonder if Spider-Bot is an evolution of, what was it, Web, I think it's called?
Yes, I think that's one of the benefits that this comic does, is that it's trying to do something that we're seeing a lot of, personally, that I keep talking about and finding in a lot of Marvel comics, is trying to bridge the gap closer and closer between the people who enjoy the Marvel movies and TV shows to the people who enjoy the Marvel comic books. I feel like it's really easy to get someone who's into the comic book to enjoy the TV show or the movie, because it's like, oh, you see your favorite character on the big screen. But it is a little bit harder to try to convince somebody to go pick up a comic, because a lot of comics, at least nowadays, if you're trying to go into the big two, I think has a lot of trepidation of not knowing where to start. But yes, for anybody who is a more of a new comic reader or someone who isn't that into comics, these Infinity comics are a really easy way to get into them, because they are very fast to read. It's very adorable. Well, I mean, this one is very adorable. Not all of them are very adorable. see, Spider Song. It's something I touched on before, is that to my knowledge, but I don't believe Peter and Tony have this kind of relationship in the comics prior to...
Well, Civil War Initiative days, before was it One More Day, they were really close, and Peter revealed his identity publicly at Iron Man's encouraging. He had the whole Iron Spider vibe, and then later, during Hickman's Avengers run, Spider-Man was on the team, and then it was Superior Spider-Man. They did have a relationship, they did interact, and I thought it was interesting in, what is it, issue 5, where Peter says that this is why he never joined the Avengers. I was like, wait a minute, you've joined the Avengers twice.
Multiple times.
What I kind of took that as, and it's one of the reasons why I really like this comic, and I think that it's something like I'd recommend to my 5-year-old nephew, is it doesn't really care about continuity a ton. It cares about it enough to pull characters in from different corners of the Marvel Universe and be like, look how expansive we are. It's not like hinging its story on like a specific point of continuity that has to happen in order for it to exist. And it's family friendly. The accessibility of this comic makes me want to recommend it so much more to, you know, everyone as a jumping on point.
I really agree. And I think that, much like Jonah was saying earlier about the crossover appeal and trying to be something to draw in, you know, different readers and non-readers and fans of different forms of media, I think that's even why they are trying to a little bit fudge the character dynamics, where, you know, Peter, you were an Avenger, what are you talking about? And while Peter had a relationship previously with Tony, I think by that point he was mostly an adult, from my understanding. Mm-hmm. So it was less the paternal, avuncular relationship that he had with Tony then, which is more what we got from the MCU, considering he was only 15 when it started. Mm-hmm. So I think they're trying to, you know, make their relationship a little bit more mentory, while also recognizing that Comic Peter is nebulously an adult, but especially these days, what the hell does an adult in your 20s even mean? So you still kind of need a guardian at that point. It's trying to juggle a lot of different balls to draw the most audience. audience.
I have a hard time reading Peter Parker as a character in his 20s still. And maybe it's just because I've grown up reading Marvel Comics, reading a lot of Spider-Man, and I'm in my 30s now. It hits me hard to think that we're still framing Peter as a character in his 20s. And that's probably very true. But that timeline, that sliding time scale.
I think there's almost an irony to the fact that the character was named Peter Parker and is now sort of a perennial Peter Pan character. It wasn't exactly the intention at the beginning of starting the title, because they couldn't have known it was going to last over 50 years. They couldn't have known everything that comics would go through and the sliding timeline that Marvel Comics would have to adapt to be able to keep going in the way it's going. But now Peter's kind of a kid forever. He keeps slamming back and forth between, is he a teenager? Is he in his 20s? Is he in his 30s by now? It depends on who's writing him. And that can be a lot to reconcile with that character, especially if you leave him for a while and then come back, or you're just coming into the title for the first time.
It's almost like you talking about that, Kev, makes me think of how Nico often talks about the characterization of Kate Pryde, often bounced between being a young child, a younger teen when she was first introduced, to then trying to age her up and be more adult-like, and that regressing multiple times and back and forth, where Kitty and / Kate has gone through multiple, I'm a bad girl now, I'm an adult, I could do things, to then being like, no,
she's a baby. I am baby.
She's the epitome of saying I am baby.
It's true.
Well, and I wonder how long it takes for us to feel that way about a character. Like at one point, do people who started reading, you know, G. Willow Wilson's Ms. Marvel 1, you know, feel like Kamala needs to, you know, be older, needs to be in her 20s instead of like a perpetual teenage superhero?
I think that's just something to say about the media, because I look at a show that was introduced to me by Kevo and Nico of Modern Family, and one of the most beautiful things about that show is that you grow up with these characters. It's a show that takes place over well over 10 years. You're with these characters for a decade. So you see these characters actually age, and if it's something that you watched when you were a teen, you were the age of one of those kids, you literally saw them grow up with you. You saw those milestones that they were portraying on TV as you were hitting them. And when it comes to comics, because the timeline is so very different, a lot of people who grow up with these characters don't see them hitting the same milestones that they are.
Yeah.
Like, I was been reading Peter Parker, not me, that's a metaphorical person. I've been reading Peter Parker for 20 years. He's not doing the same things I'm doing.
Yeah, I think it's a lot easier to show time movement in television and, I guess, sort of movies, where it kind of lines up with what you're doing. You hit your Christmas moment, you hit your graduation moment, you hit your birthday moment every year. Whereas in comics, because they come out once a month, and you sort of have to know that the arc of like battling with Kingpin for 4 issues is going to take you 4 months in real time, but be a week in their time. And in the meantime, some other comic in the same universe has fast forwarded 6 months. Like, it's just,
but they're gonna connect, so watch out.
They're gonna get back together, it's gonna be fine. But I think that that's part of what the difficulty in comics aging is that you either sort of have to freeze frame everyone into like a 3 to 4 year loop, or you have to like every 100 issues be like, okay, it's been 2 years, and just like push forward from there. And so, like, because Nico and I are starting Daredevil from the beginning, and it's very 1960s, and we're gonna get like decade markers kind of in fashion and in current events and speech
grit level of New York.
Yep, absolutely. You know,
but Matt Murdock is still gonna be what, 25, 28, Karen's eternally 24. Like, nobody ages until they sort of have to start pushing up, because too many people have died that if you keep saying it's the same year, like, someone should be like in a hospital, like a psychiatric
ward. You need therapy with all these people that died this year, and you're just completely shoving that down, aren't you?
Yeah, welcome.
That's very on brand for Matt, though.
Yeah, that's pretty David Gore for Matt. He's got God. What else does he need? So yeah, I'm fully with you. Like, it can be hard, but at the same time, like, those archetypes, like, do we want a Spider-Man who has 12 years of Spider-Maning weighing him
back
down?
And back problems and bills.
I kind of do, but like, I love slice of life comics. So like, I want to see a retired 34-year-old Spider-Man dealing with the fact fact that he somehow passed on his genetic spider abilities to his kids with MJ, and now we have spider babies, like babies who have spider powers going around. And like, what does that mean? Like, that to me is interesting, but I know like other people aren't into that, so like whatever.
Well, and the robot of it all really sidesteps this problem, because yes. You've got these characters that don't have to age at all. And I think this was, remember whenever this was coming out, there was a Herbie comic that was geared towards kids and was, again, like, it was able to sidestep the issue of continuity by just making it a robot who, you know, doesn't age and can be reset and lose all of their experience. And there's just a lot of like narrative convenience by making that the jump on character.
Absolutely. And there's something to be say about robotic characters, or using characters specifically for certain medias and genres. I think these robots lend themselves well to doing things that are either geared towards younger audiences or towards something you were saying, Tori, slice of life, because that's what a lot of these Infinity comics tend to lean towards, because they're so short as well as concise that you don't have a lot of time to be spending on bigger action panels and bigger action sequences. You have to get to your point very quickly. So a lot of what I'm finding with these Infinity comics is that they're better geared towards the genre of slice of life. And that's kind of what we see across these six issues. It's a slice of life moment of like, okay, the first issue, Peter Parker orders his task box to go get a bacon, egg, and cheese, salt, pepper, ketchup. That is the most New York thing to order.
And also it's on the wrong bun. When they show it, it's on the wrong bun.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm a hero. It's absolutely ridiculous.
First off, thank you for saying the proper term hero. I've got too many arguments over people over here in Philly.
I mean, I call it a sub, but when I'm referring to the roll, a sub is a sandwich. A roll is a hero.
Plus absolutely. The context of what we're discussing, you just have to.
Yeah. It's a hero sandwich.
It's a hero sandwich. Why is it not on a everything bagel?
That's literally... Kaiser roll for an egg, yes. Bacon, for a sausage, egg, and cheese. You want a Kaiser roll?
Absolutely. It's we're only digged points there. It's taking that moment of, okay, how does he get this sandwich to try to make up for MJ's birthday? Which Peter, please.
How do people forget people's birthdays? Like, I understand to a degree, but is that not your girlfriend? Do you not talk to her?
Hey, no. I did it once when I was 14. We forgot mom's birthday because it was right after the divorce and like no adult told us what it was. And the next day a plane hit the Twin Towers. So like, we don't fucking do that anymore.
But like, you're 14 and that's your mom. Yeah. That's very different.
I don't know. I fully buy into the idea that Peter is terrible at communicating with any of his intimate partners. Fully.
And you know what? Always. Peter would forget his own birthday. And so I will allow it for a character like this, who would be like, oh, it was my birthday yesterday.
Very Liz Lemon.
Yeah, exactly.
And wow, Spider-Man really is the Liz Lemon of the Marvel Universe.
Oh, totally.
Spider-Man is also that, like, nobody likes you when you're 23 song.
The Blink-182 song?
Yeah, that one.
When all of my friends in our friend group, we turned 23 on their birthday, we played that song for them.
Good.
But did you play Taylor Swift when you turned 22?
Well, yes. I feel like you're contractually obligated.
See, I turned 22 before that happened. So I was like, haha, suck it.
I did not.
Way before that happened.
I did not. I was young, bopped to that song thinking, I can't wait to be 22. And then I turned 24 and I'm like... Well,
why did I do this?
Is it better? Sure. Are there just different problems?
But
back to what we were talking about before.
Robot spider.
How could he forget her birthday? She's the best thing that's ever happened to him.
And why is the spider bot? Why isn't one of its tasks not that? You don't. It's fine.
Calendar function.
Yeah.
Well, that's something I imagine with a lot of Stark technology is that it's so advanced that you have to lose certain functionality that you would think would be basic. Like a lot of smartphones and a lot of devices nowadays can tell you the time, tell you the date, tell you all these different facts. I feel like Stark technology is so advanced that he's like, why would I put that in there? Everything else already has that. It doesn't need to tell you dates.
Goddamn geniuses.
Meanwhile, Pepper's over here, like, you could put in a reminder.
It's literally just a calendar, Tony. It's literally just a calendar.
It is a calendar, and Peter does not know how to use one. So this idea of little spider bots are going to go get the sandwich, which is then has to be this whole kerfuffle and shenanigans because the Thing wants it. And they, for some reason, the Thing on his mobile has Pym Particle it's a little bit of a stretch as to why Ben's hovercraft ship thing has a Pym particle laser on it. But sure, that's what he took to go get his bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich.
I'm shocked that it isn't fantastic tech.
One of the hardest things for me about, you know, not just reading comics, but just certain fiction, like the sandwich itself, this is New York City. That was not your last bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich.
No.
That is bullshit, but it's a comic book, and it's just silly shenanigans. That sandwich, oh no, wait, it was for Petunia. I was going to say, that's not enough for Ben. You need more food. Why are you mad about this sandwich? But right, okay, it was for someone else. But again, they had to engineer this thing as to why the thing is picking up the sandwich, but it's not for him. You got to roll with it. Sure. Now, is there just some
Kaiser roll with it?
You got a Kaiser roll with it.
Like, there's probably just a giant pigeon out there in New York City now. They didn't fix that. And that's just...
But that's par for the course for 616.
That might have been Fing Fing Foom's next meal.
Yeah, that I was would love dessert. If that is a recurring character now.
Is this a giant pigeon that they were just like, just leave it. What is it gonna, it doesn't do anything. It still tries to sit on top of buildings. And like sometimes.
Oh my god, that would be so cute. We're all so easy.
Marvel, this all writes itself.
Give us the giant pigeon comic that we're all craving.
But I would love to know, is there a character that you would think that these spider bots would interact well with?
Danger. I want to see that.
I get that.
Because they're so funny and Danger is so serious. And I want that like odd couple or I don't know, however many spider bots are there. I want that interplay. And I think I'd really enjoy the humor that comes out of it.
What's a Danger?
Oh, Danger is the sentient AI of the X-Men's former Danger Room.
Oh, it's it is the Danger Room. Okay.
Yeah. She got boobs.
Oh, good for her.
And she was a love interest of Warlock's for a while, too, and is currently MIA.
That's probably why. That's probably the only reason we haven't seen her so far.
Yeah, she's like in the belly of Krakoa. I mean, just from a restorative justice perspective, she deserves a place there. X has cut her out enough.
I'm genuinely surprised by the appearances we've gotten so far in this title, so I don't even know what to expect. I wouldn't have anticipated MODOK. I wouldn't have anticipated that poker game. I would not have anticipated the appearance of the Bastard J. Jonah Jameson. They're really themselves without any prompting, putting out so many cute and interesting concepts that I wouldn't have thought of. So I don't even know what to suggest. Shoving them all in the Iron Man suit. That was a great idea, and I never would have even come to me.
I want some Amelia Bedelia-esque like cleaning shenanigans for Aunt May.
Okay, yeah.
That'd be cute.
I would love them to interact with Jeff the Land Shark.
I want everyone to interact with Jeff the Land Shark. So.
Jeff the Land Shark, as everybody knows, is the most important character in Marvel history. He is everything.
He's the cutest. He's a salmon shark, right? Because he's a cute looking great white.
Who is Jeff the Land Shark?
Oh my god!
Okay, someone needs to tell me who the most important character in the Marvel Universe is.
Baby shark.
I never know things people don't.
Jeff the Land Shark is, as his name suggests, he is a land shark that is small like a puppy.
Yes.
And he acts like a puppy, but is also a shark. And
is also semi-sentient, a la Bronx from Gargoyles.
Yes. Like, okay. He is a little scamp, and to, you know, keep on current theme, if you need something to read about him that kind of just gives you everything you need to know, he has an Infinity comic, which is probably one of the greatest things that's been ever written.
Yes.
But he was basically like Wade's ward for a long time, but before that he was Gwenpool's, and then Gwenpool, when she wanted to go to Krakoa and she realized, I can't take care of Jeff, there's just too much going on in my life right now, she gave him to Deadpool. Deadpool took care of him for a while over in his comic while he was being the king of Staten Island, because he was the king of monsters, and everybody on Staten Island is a monster.
We love to see it.
Well, that sounds like an amazing little buddy.
Yes, he is very cute, very adorable. He loves to bite things. Emma Frost loves him. She wants to keep him as a pet, and Wade said no, but he did say how much. What I really appreciate about these Infinity comics, besides being like, here's a whole bunch of characters these little buddy robots can interact with, I really appreciated Jordan's use of comedy, because this is unironically, and not me brown-nosing, and not me joking, quite possibly some of the funniest things I've ever read. And it's not always the newest material, but for some reason, it's really funny. Like, I almost died when Mole Man was trying to come at a Twitter troll because he said that Mole Man looks like the kind of guy MODOK hangs out with to look cute. And like, so one, obviously, it's a very hysterical statement. That is amazing. Two, that there are Twitter people making fun of supervillains.
Because there would be.
And three, that Mole Man is on Twitter and is very reactive and upset over this.
I want to know who the supervillain fans are, though. Like, who's the biggest Mole Man stan and how did they become that?
Interesting. And even not necessarily like, I'm going to go join him in his evil plans, but like, who runs his Twitter fan account and is like, yes, he's right.
Yeah, who's doing the fan cams for Mole Man?
I mean, there's like a million people already on Twitter saying Thanos was right, so like, there's gonna be somebody.
That's why they wrote it into the Hawkeye series. I doubt that the writers themselves thought of it before the memes started happening. I'm sure putting it in the show was a reaction to seeing actual people behave that way. Because like, you want to hope they won't, and then they do.
The double-edged sword about Infinity Comics is that they are a lot of fun to read and they're very enjoyable to talk about, but there isn't as much content as always to like really deep dust in disguise, and they're like, they're not really heavy themes or motifs or things you're looking at. It's really cute art and wacky situations most of the time.
And that's why 10 came out in 2 months. Like, you need to have more of them for that reason. Wait, they come out on Fridays and not Wednesdays? That's so weird.
I thought they came out on Tuesdays for some reason.
I just thought all comics come out on Wednesdays.
No, this one came out. That's why when I was talking to Nico, I like looked down and I was like, this came out yesterday. So it came out on the 11th.
Things that get printed come out on Wednesday, but their digital exclusives, I think, come out on different days.
Doing great.
Books like this really do offer a lot of that like connective tissue of the Marvel Universe, though, by virtue of the fact that they're accessible, by virtue of the fact that they bring in so many characters from different corners, and they are tied to one of the major franchise characters. Like, again, this is a book that I will absolutely share with my nephew because he's 5 and loves Spider-Man, and I don't want to show him any of the ongoing comics because they're ongoing and confusing, and this is like a perfect jumping on point. He'll love spider robots.
Absolutely. And it's something I believe you mentioned earlier in the episode, Kevo. These are another great thing for merchandising. Not that everything any creator has to make all this connective idea of like, this was created for this. But these robots are so adorable. I can see plenty of action figures, little mini robots that like do very limited things, plushes. It's part of making brands and part of making characters. You have to think about that idea of sellability and printability.
Mm-hmm. It's like the minion effect.
Oh my god, minions.
Minions.
I think I saw the first 2 Despicable Me movies. I think I only remember the second one. I don't hate it. I just don't get it.
I'm told that the Minions movie is better.
Fascinating. My favorite thing about Minions is, to my understanding, Minions, in their universe and in their lore, are attracted to the most evil being, and that's who they follow. That's who they're Minions for.
Mm-hmm.
Except during World War II, where all Minions were on Antarctica. For convenient and implicit and great reasonings as to why they were there.
I think that is
a genius way to avoid any and all future complications.
It would have been funnier if they like were just like, no, there was a penguin that was eviler than Hitler. I don't know. Have you seen that fucker?
I do love that, but I also love the idea of they were like, this guy's too evil even for us. Let's get out of here.
Who else could the Spider-Bots follow if not Peter? Could the Spider-Bots follow clone Peter? Or Ben, I guess is his name, right? Or are they specifically keyed to Peter Parker?
Would they follow any spider?
Would they follow...
Isn't there a Miles Morales appearance at some point? Or is that
picturing them literally following a spider.
That's a great idea for a comic where they just follow a spider thinking it's Peter.
That's my bid now.
Or if someone reads them Charlotte's Web, oh my god.
Oh gosh.
I would cry.
I was going to ask, would they follow Ben Reilly around? Because Ben Reilly is just Peter Parker. Mm. He's a clone.
Can they tell the difference?
Well, that's
Ben Dice's hair, yes.
That's definitely something I would want to see then. I would like to see them interact with other spiders. Is it just Peter or, you know?
They are, you know, linked to Peter intrinsically. Do they follow his, like, heart? So they, do they love MJ? Do they secretly love Felicia?
Ooh.
Do you think that the spiders ship Peter with certain characters more than others?
The spider bots do run spiders' Twitter.
Oh, no, I just figured it out. So the spider bots ship Peter and Felicia more than they ship Peter and MJ. So they purposely didn't tell him it was MJ's birthday.
Ooh.
This is my new headcanon.
There's your no prize.
Guys, I have a late in the episode game changer for all of you.
Okay.
Go.
Interactive remote control spider bots are available at Avengers Campus.
Shut the fuck up.
Boom. Mic drop.
It's Spider Bot. It is him.
Do
it's
they have
the
little
look.
Legs and everything, or are they on
yeah.
wheels?
Oh. No, he has little legs. He's got the little legs that move.
Well, now you need to take a trip so that you can drug mule all of us, these little spider bots.
Not only that, but it looks like he comes in multiple variants, including Iron Man, Black Widow, Black Panther, and others. I want to say that might be War Machine.
So we're
getting multiple, huh?
So we're going to commercial the fuck out of the rest of this episode. I am desperate. We all need different ones.
Yes!
So from ones that I can see, it looks like there's a Wasp and an Ant-Man one.
Yep.
Is there not a Captain Marvel one?
Not yet, it seems. But I imagine once she has another movie coming out, we are probably going to get a Marvel's one. It's Iron Man, Black Widow, Black Panther, Ant-Man and Wasp.
Hulk?
Is it a Hawkeye one? There's
no.
A purple.
I think purple might be Black Panther.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. And I see the difference, Black Panther and Black Widow. Okay.
Interesting anyway, that they have Ant-Man cool. and Wasp.
Well,
they are insects.
That's true. That's a really good point, too.
Well, hold on. Actually, push up my glasses. Spiders aren't insects. But like,
all right, oh, bitch.
Yeah, all right,
sorry.
See, and that's the correct spot where someone's being pedantic and trying to one up and be like, this knowledge. Who cares? It's cute.
My actual response is bugs. They're bugs. They're still bugs. So Iron Man and Black Panther are the standouts then.
You know what I really want to see is a superior spider bot?
That would be another really great title to see.
Ooh, Ultimate Spider Bot.
Like BB-8 versus the evil BB-8 from Star Wars Episode 8.
There's an evil BB-8?
Yeah, he's an Imperial version.
Aww.
Okay, well, I'll look this up after.
Okay, well, he obviously needs a hug. What if we had tiny little spider bots that are really, really small and they just hang out on Man Spider's body, like making sure that he's all clean and stuff?
Oh, the symbiotic relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He protects them, they clean him. Yeah.
Poor Man Spider.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay.
when did J. Jonah Jameson get a werewolf astronaut son?
Oh, that's been around for a while.
For a while.
His son was an astronaut, went to the moon.
We've gotten very close to introducing that full character into the movies a few times. You actually meet J. Jonah Jameson's astronaut son in the Tobey Maguire films.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe Jameson is one of the astronauts in the Venom films who are partially responsible for bringing the symbiotes to Earth in that branch of that franchise. I would have to double check myself before I am certain, but we definitely saw astronauts doing it, so not like that.
So John Jonah Jameson III, which is his son, is Man-Wolf.
Yes.
Oh, Man-Wolf, not Werewolf by Night. Okay, that's a different...
I also thought he was Werewolf by Night, so I was with you. And that would make more sense.
Oh,
he's an astronaut.
The character? I thought you just meant, like, at night. He's a werewolf.
There's a comic called Werewolf by Night.
Oh, yeah. No.
He is a monster who you can see over working under Michael Morbius in the likes of Legion of Monsters.
Goodness.
He also kind of, like, has this thing with Elsa Bloodstone, and it's kind of hot.
Woof.
Wolf, exactly.
Literally.
Yeah, Wolf, literally. I would say the thing I'm most excited about is the fact that we already have three more issues to read, and I'm excited to come back and continue covering this title. It's adorable. It deserves attention. You know, this is the sort of thing that people are always looking for. You know, you see fan-made cartoons like this in your Facebook feed all the time. So the fact that it is out there from the company itself using all of their properties together like this, I think it is a great product. I'm glad that it's out there, and I think people need to be more aware that these titles exist.
Agreed.
Yeah.